You're listening to Software Unscripted. I'm your host, Richard Feldman. Today I'm talking to Nathan Sobo, founder of Zed Industries, a company which makes a new code editor called Zed that I've personally been using and loving for Rust development. We talk about his time as an early developer on the Atom code editor, including how that project led to Electron and later Visual Studio Code, and then about how a focus on taking performance beyond what was possible with web technologies led the Zed team to create GPUI, which uses native operating system APIs for events and goes straight to the graphics card for rendering. And now, native UIs without Electron. All right, Nathan, thanks for joining me.
Absolutely.
So you were part of the team that originally created Electron, which, as I understand it, was a spinoff from the Atom editor at GitHub before it was acquired by Microsoft. And then now you've gone on to create Zed, which is an awesome new editor, and also a new sort of spin-off UI framework from that called GPUI, which is very different from Electron. So I'd love to just get a little bit more understanding of sort of how that history happened. How did you end up creating Electron? How did you end up creating GPUI? What are your feelings about how Electron has turned out in the world? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I've probably talked on maybe one other podcast about the kind of the story of Electron. Some people may have heard this, but I'll just tell it again in case they haven't. When I joined GitHub in like the very end of 2011, it was right after I pitched them on this idea I had of wanting to build a collaborative editor. And they had actually been working on an editor, Chris and Corey Johnson. Chris, the founder of GitHub, and Corey, like a really early employee at GitHub, had been working on an editor for a few weeks. And it was basically back in the day, like now WebKit, if you want to use like WebKit inside of a Mac application, it's like completely isolated in its own process and you can't do anything. But back then, WebKit actually had like a super rich bridging layer where it could actually bridge directly into Objective-C. And so Chris, the editor, was originally called Atomicity. And his idea was to sort of start, it was ACE. Remember the ACE editor?
Oh, yeah. Like JavaScript, it runs in the browser.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So they had taken ACE and then opened up a few different bindings for I.O. via this Objective-C bridge. All the bindings for I.O. were like synchronous, so it was very much a prototype, right? Like you can't block while you're loading a file or something from disk, right? But you know, I pitched them on the idea of building an editor, and they're like, check out what we're building. And it was pretty interesting. And I kind of hemmed and hawed because I was worried about, from before I even joined, I was like, is this going to be performant enough? Because what I had in mind was to kind of build something in C or C++, which, to be honest, I had a little bit of those technologies, but I would have had a lot to learn to be building an editor at that point. So yeah, we started working in that modality with WebKit. And I was like, well, if we're going to like really do this, I want to load NPM packages, have access to the whole library ecosystem. It was very limited at the time. And so we started trying to figure out how to make that work. It was not obvious at all how the hell to make that work.
So this is like NPM packages for you to use while developing the editor, or people using the editor can use NPM packages to build extensions and stuff?
I wanted both. Yeah. Because like Chris was like, I want to build the most hackable editor ever, like a modern Emacs. And I was just envisioning like this playground where you've got the DOM and CSS. You can, these really familiar technologies, and pull in this libraries of different, you know, this whole ecosystem. But at that point, there was sort of Node in its world. And then there was like JavaScript you ran in the browser in its world. And there was not a lot of overlap between those two in like 2012.
Right. I remember, I think that was the era where Browserify came out, which was this way to, I think it was take Node packages off of NPM, which at that time they were all just for Node and not for the browser. And you could package them up in a way that would actually, or bundle them up in a way that would run in the browser.
Right. In retrospect, I don't know that we necessarily even needed the full power of Node and all these NPM libraries in a browser environment. But I don't know. I think I hadn't learned the lesson of just the right amount of power. Anything is possible. Let's make this happen. So we hired, there was this thing called the Chromium Embedded Framework. So yeah, me at the time, I was like, okay, well, if we're going to use Node and NPM, like that's all based on V8. But here we are in WebKit, which is like JavaScript core. And so I'm like, okay, well, let's try to use Chrome. We contracted with this guy, Marshall, I forget his last name, who had the Chromium embedded framework. And we were trying to make this work. And I was kind of like poking around on the internet mailing lists and asking a couple questions. And then at some point, Cheng reached out to me and was just, I love GitHub. I want to help you make this happen, this thing you're asking about doing. So we get on a Skype call with him and barely understand each other because he lived in, I don't know if it was Beijing. Anyway, he barely spoke English and I definitely don't speak Mandarin. And the only thing I could think to tell him is just write down the clearest, this is what we need you to build. And it's like, I need the node ecosystem. I need you to basically integrate Node's event loop with the event loop that's already inside of Chrome. And I hadn't made the first clue, but I needed a lot more clues than that to make that happen. And so he started working on it and it was crashing. And there were many months where like I was just wondering, like, is this ever going to work? But we got it stable and started and switched off of like the WebKit thing we had been doing. Or maybe we were on Chromium embedded for a little bit. I don't remember if there was ever like an Atom that lived during that time. And so like, yeah, while I was involved in sort of, or instrumental in making Electron happen, I didn't really create it, to be fair. Like Cheng was really the driving force behind it, actually writing that software that merged the two event loops and made it happen.
Right, because the browser event loop, like the browser is, I don't know what the file system is. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have any of these like Node APIs. And then on the Node side, it's like, I don't know what a DOM is. I don't know how to render anything. And so you wanted to get both.
Right. But all the Node code was based on libuv, and the browser doesn't know anything about libuv.
Exactly, yeah. Even though they're both V8.
Yeah, so it was a pretty crazy, yeah, and it was some pretty crazy C++ that integrated these two involving, yeah, I don't know. I can't really speak super intelligently about it. It was a long time ago, and I barely understood it.
Sure, yeah.
To be honest,
okay. Yeah. So was it always his project was to make Electron, or was it at this point it was still all just Atom? And I think in the same way that maybe like libuv, if I remember right, was sort of split off from Node later.
Right.
Was that the same way with Electron? Like initially it was just like, we're doing this for Atom or Atomicity.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I remember he's like, I want to call it Direwolf. And I was just like, okay, well, I don't think we should call it Direwolf. So I was like, let's just call it Atom Shell. Because like, I just wanted a neutral, just boring name for this thing.
Yeah.
But then Atom Shell, I think Chris was really the one that came up with the Electron name. But, you know, it's like the orbital shell of the Atom or whatever.
Right.
Parked that name. And, you know, it was a twinkle in my eye that maybe it would go on to be useful outside of Atom. But my philosophy is always very much like, don't borrow trouble. Let's just focus on what we need for Atom. Let's just make that work. That was our laser focus for quite a while. And it wasn't until a little bit later that we generalized it.
Because that ended up being, I mean, I guess certainly VS Code, obviously, which, I mean, we can talk about that too. But like, I mean, VS Code came along, used Electron, which came out of Atom, to make an Atom competitor, which ultimately ended up being more popular than Atom. And ultimately, I mean, I guess after the acquisition, especially, you could argue there's an interesting alternate timeline question where it's like, if you don't split out Electron, does VS Code take over and replace Atom? Or is it still like everybody's using Atom today? I don't know.
Yeah, it's an interesting, I mean, I think that we did a lot of things. You know, I was very young and had a lot to learn when we started Atom. I still have a lot to learn. I'm just not as young anymore.
Yeah, big feels.
Yeah, and so I think like a lot of Atom losing to VS Code was kind of our own doing. We made some mistakes, and there was a perspective that they were coming from. But remember, that team worked on Eclipse. It was Eric Gamble.
Yeah.
It was not their first rodeo. It definitely was our first rodeo. So it was kind of a sad story of, in a lot of ways, like taking a lot of the arrows of how do you, you know, inventing Electron, which like,
yeah,
while I didn't write a lot of the software, I still sweated a lot of the, you know, it was still a big part of the start of Atom was just building that infrastructure to make that possible, a desktop app in web tech. And, but then I think, you know, we didn't use a typed language, you know, so we wrote it originally in CoffeeScript, which wouldn't have been my choice, but it showed up like a few weeks in and I wasn't going to be that guy that's like, let me quibble about the language we're writing this in. It's just like, not, you know.
Well, and if I remember right, I think the config files were CoffeeScript flavored JSON, right? It was like CSON or something.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
That's my memory of like how I knew that Adam was CoffeeScript related.
Yeah, I don't know. I remember at some point we've been working on it for a really long time, and it really was not ready even then. But Tom kind of gave us an ultimatum of, wasn't it this explicit, but I kind of read between the lines of, ship this or we're canceling it.
Yeah, yeah.
And kind of what this buggy, kind of slow editor had to offer when it came out was like being implemented in Webtech and being hackable. And so we just opened up all this API surface area, which made it really popular, but also kind of sealed our fate of like, you know, when you take something that's not ready and then make a bunch of promises to the whole world of all these things they can do with it. Congratulations. Yeah.
I heard you on a different podcast talking about some of the sort of design decision regrets around that, around like basically opening up so much that it just became a constraint for you as developers, where you're like, oh, we want to improve the performance of this thing, but we can't, because the way that we would improve it is that we would have to remove something that a bunch of extensions are relying on being true.
Yeah. Yeah. And we made like a lot of progress despite that, deprecating things and like, but it was hard, you know, and also not having any types didn't make it any easier, and letting, not having any privacy rules where people could reach into stuff that even we didn't even intend to expose, but they would just dig into the internals of something.
Ah, yeah.
And then that extension that they made became super popular. And I'm like, okay, well, I guess this is an API now.
Right. The all well.
Like ruined. Right. I don't know. It was a really tough
Hiram's Law
spot to be in. Whereas I think the VS Code team, we did kind of roll out the red carpet by creating Electron, showed that this like way, because my understanding is, take this with a grain of salt, because it's just like my understanding, was they were working on like Visual Studio Online. And then I think we
kind of sounds right. Yeah, with Monaco.
Like a web desktop app hybrid. I don't know. Maybe they would have done that anyway. Maybe not. But I think we definitely did a lot of things wrong. I don't know. They defeated us, but in many ways, we defeated ourselves. And
I mean, I'm very interested in how and why technologies get adopted. Whenever I hear, oh, this happened because of this, there's always more to the story. I'm really interested in the like more to the story part. And with VS Code, I remember being there and I remember people saying, hey, you should check out this new editor, VS Code. And I was like, oh, like, what's its deal? Like, why is it cool? You know, I was using Atom at the time and they're like, oh, it's like Atom. And I was like, okay, but like, why would I switch to it? I don't know. It's pretty cool. I don't remember the selling point. And like, I remember resisting changing to it for a long time or even trying it out just because no one seemed, I couldn't remember anyone articulating to me what a benefit would be. I'm like, okay, so it's like the same kind of thing, but now I have to like redo all my configs in this new thing. I don't know. What's the upside for me as the person using the editor? To this day, I cannot remember someone like selling me on VS Code. It was just eventually all the extension momentum moved there. And I was like, all right, well, I guess I got to finally switch. But I don't know how that happened. How did it occur that so many people, I mean, I know from your perspective, like from a technical perspective, there were like performance concerns, et cetera, but it's not like VS Code, especially back then, was like this blazing fast experience. So
I think it had a lot to do with TypeScript, honestly. It was like the killer app for editing TypeScript, which makes sense because Microsoft invented TypeScript and it was implemented in TypeScript. And so they created the language server protocol, which ironically, they still, to my understanding, don't speak the language server protocol with the TypeScript compiler. That's still some proprietary or like non-standard thing. But they created the language server protocol to kind of incentivize other communities to come to VS Code and provide tooling for it. It was really pretty brilliant. Yeah, I mean, Atom was a text editor that was fun and hackable, and VS Code was an IDE. And so I think that play of creating the language server protocol and being a great tool for editing TypeScript, which was really, you know, had its rise, I think, concurrent with VS Code's rise, was like why they won.
Okay, I remember that from the TypeScript side, but I hadn't really put two and two together to realize that maybe that was a self-reinforcing thing where like, I remember when TypeScript was coming out and it was still kind of a controversial thing and some people were like, oh, it's really cool. And some people were like, I don't know. I'd go to these conferences and I would talk to people and I was doing Elm development on the front end, so I didn't care. But I would ask people like, hey, what do you think of TypeScript? And you know, some of them would say, oh, I haven't tried it. Or some would say, oh, I try it and I love it, et cetera. And of the people who like it, I'd ask, like, well, what do you like about it? And the most consistent answer I got was, I love the red squiggle. In my editor, it tells me, and of course, their editor was always VS Code. It hadn't occurred to me that that UX was not just something that made TypeScript take off, but also it was something that made VS Code take off.
Yeah, that's my like analysis of the situation. And like lessons that I learned from that were sort of ignoring TypeScript for too long. And I think having written some early Java and C++ and stuff, I don't know, earlier in my career, I was kind of like a dynamic typing. I love dynamic typing. I love the lack of bothering me with all this boring type thing. And so it took me a while to come around to the realization, like, nope, static types are actually super important to like scaling a big project. And by then it was just, it is what it is. It was fun at the time.
Yeah. So I have some theories, but I actually gave a talk called Why Static Typing Came Back. I talk to a lot of people who are about my age who have a similar, or got into programming like in the 90s, who have a similar journey where they started out with Java and C++. I'm like, man, this is really slow and clunky and not worth it. And then they got into dynamic languages, which got big with web development getting big. And they're like, oh, this is so much better. I text mate Sublime Text for life. And then eventually kind of came back around to static types. And for those who haven't seen the talk, I'm not going to like spoil the ending or anything, but a lot of people will say stuff like, oh, the pendulum's going to swing back, this is how it goes. And I'm like, nope. It's not. But like, I explain why in the talk. But
yeah, and I think type systems have come a long way.
Well, and I mean, this is a really underrated and easy to overlook thing, but also we have multi-core processors now. Back when I was using Eclipse in Java, when it was doing all that type checking and indexing, it was blocking the render thread. So of course everything felt slow and laggy. Like you couldn't do it on another thread. Or I mean, you could do it on another thread, but it was still on the same CPU core.
Yeah, totally.
So just the fact that even if you kept all the type systems the same and all the languages the same, just the fact that the hardware got better means that you can have a much better IDE experience now than you could back then. And the sluggishness of them was, in my mind, the main downside and the main reason that it was so much more enjoyable to use Sublime Text, TextMate, and all them.
Yeah, but then there's Rust, which is, you know, needs even more cores.
Yeah, I know. I mean, people who've heard this podcast for a while have heard me complain about this for a long time. I like so many things about Rust, the compile times. We actually had one of the Rust people who works, Nathan Nethercoat, who works on performance, although he works on the front end for the Rust compiler. And I think performance problems are mostly at other parts of the compiler. But yeah, it's very frustrating. And also, I don't unfortunately see it getting any better on the Rust side. So we kind of got to hope that hardware bails us out at some point.
Yeah. And I'm complaining, but like my overwhelming reaction to Rust is like, thank God, this is the coolest technology.
And that's what you've built. I mean, so transitioning maybe to, you know, okay, so that was Atom, that was Electron. And now, you know, you've built this new thing, built on new technologies. And I'm curious to hear, I mean, I've heard like bits and pieces of it on other podcasts, but I'm kind of curious to hear your thoughts and sort of feelings around, okay, now looking back on Electron, how do you feel? I mean, also a lot of people in the industry complain about Electron. They're like, hey, this is like really slow and bloated. Why is the memory footprint so big? Why do I have an Xbox 360 controller in every single desktop app? You know, because that's like part of Chromium, so it's in there. How do you feel about that?
I mean, I can see why people complain. And at the time, it was just like the best option for writing a cross-platform desktop app.
I mean, arguably it still is, and that's why everybody keeps using it. You know, it's like, it's really easy to say, hey, why don't you use something else? Or like, specifically what else?
Yeah. And, you know, to the degree that my only answer to that question, you know, as I started to contemplate what was next, was to like build that other thing, you know, like, so
yeah.
I don't know. It seems fine. It's like, but it does seem a little ridiculous to like ship an entire copy of a web browser with every single app.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah. There are a lot of downsides to it. And, you know, everything's a trade-off. Obviously, I am moving on. So I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, I don't really do things like this, but I've had like a hack project or something where I needed a desktop app with like a quick UI that I was whipping up, I'd probably do it in GPUI at this point.
Yeah.
Being reasonable to like reach for Electron. But yeah, it's a bummer a little bit. We still use Slack internally at the company and like it just feels a little sluggish.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't love web tech. I love the web, but I don't
Yeah. I know that feeling.
I can build a desktop app in technology that wasn't really designed for that purpose.
And this is a thing I hear from a lot of people also who've like had similar journeys to, I think, the one that both you and I have had, which is sort of getting into programming maybe before the web was big, seeing it get big, really falling in love. I mean, the thing that I always loved about the web as like an application platform is the distribution model, where you don't have to download an installer, you don't have to get updates, you just type in the name of the thing you want and you press enter and you're using the latest version. Ah, it's like that UX is so great. But on the other hand, now at the time, I always kind of assumed, yeah, there are some performance limitations, but they'll fix those, eventually. And having tried to push the limits of that multiple different ways in my career, I've ended up just hitting this immovable barrier where it's like, no, there's just some stuff that just never feels as nice as if you do it as native alternatives. I mean, I always go back to this fond memories I have of Winamp, the old like music player, and I compare that to today's desktop clients. And Electron's probably some part of that, but also another part of that is probably just like they wrote all the logic's written in JavaScript rather than in Winamp, I'm sure was like a mix of C and C++. I just remember like I was running that on like 133 megahertz Pentium with other applications running and everything was fine. It was able to just do that. What single core? And nowadays it's like, yeah, you have whatever your music player of choice is running in the background. It's probably Electron and it's probably using gigabytes of memory that computer back then did not even have gigabytes of memory. It had like 256 megs of RAM. And when I told people I got a computer with 256 megs of RAM, they were like, are you joking? That's so much RAM.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But again, it's like, I mean, another thing that I loved about the web as I was kind of coming of age was I liked Ruby and I liked JavaScript. I liked like approachable languages that didn't make me screw around with header files and fight linking errors and obscure flags that I needed to pass to the compiler and make files and all this stuff that just, the web just felt like, oh, Ruby? Sweet. I remember watching DHH just like in TextMate on that original little demo of Rails. And to contrast that to what I'd done in college in C++, that was so appealing. So I feel like the cool thing about Rust is you kind of get the best of both worlds. Like you're getting a really nice development experience, modulo, sometimes waiting on Rust Analyzer or the compiler, but getting the same power that those more like arcane technologies give you.
And I remember going from C++ to Java even, or let alone like a JavaScript or a Ruby, distinctly remembering, wow, I don't get segmentation fault ever anymore. And I really don't miss that. Like memory corruption errors in general. And obviously like Rust still has unsafe blocks. You still can create those. But by and large, my experience with Rust has actually been that it just delivers on writing Rust doesn't really feel similar to me to writing like C or C++ back in the day. Now, granted, we did have a previous episode with Casey Muratori, who made a really interesting case that, without going into too much detail, I mean, I guess I could summarize his point as malloc and free are kind of the reason that people have so much trouble with memory management in C and C++. And if you instead are more focused on sort of arena allocation and things like that, and thinking more about lifetimes rather than just being like, whenever I need a thing, it's new or malloc, and then whenever I need to free it, it's free or destructor, and I don't know, whatever. And then he says you end up with this pointer jungle and like the lifetimes are really complicated. But if you instead are thinking more about, okay, how long do I need this memory to last? Where can I stick it so that it's, going to last that long? Then you don't end up with that same category of problems or nearly as many seg faults, etc. To be fair, I don't actually know how you would do something like that as well in an editor. I mean, I guess you could have something along the lines of kind of not really arenas, but like, I guess you can call them arenas. I mean, you could say like, here's a pool of memory for each open buffer, for example. But at that point, you still need free lists and stuff like that. You still need all the like malloc type machinery, because at the end of the day, you're going to be constantly making new allocations when people make edits and then constantly needing to deallocate things. So I don't know how you really get away with that in a use case like an editor.
We use an arena and, one choice spot in GPUI. But yeah, I don't know. But it's not just the memory management story for me. Like there's other parts of it of just like, how do you build? How do you pull in dependencies?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
The syntax is something as vain as that. But
it's a big deal. Yeah.
Those older technologies have been evolving for a really long time. Different ideas introduced at different points. And like, for someone that's an expert in that whole lineage, it's not a big deal. But I don't know. I wrote enough C++ to be like, not, I just didn't care for it on
it. Yeah, it didn't spark joy.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not just the memory story, it's the whole package. And I felt like, you know, Ruby, that was like one of the first language I wrote like professionally. You know, it had its issues and warts too, especially when I come back to it. Or, you know, the last time I wrote any Ruby was like working on github.com at the very end of my time there, and definitely had plenty to complain about. But like, I don't know, by comparison, just the whole experience of working in it felt very well designed. The developer experience was really good.
Yeah.
And that's because it didn't date back to like Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie.
Right.
Like on a teletype, it had the benefit of the internet existing, or, you know, consumer internet existing when it rose to prominence. And I think Rust even more so. Rust was a language designed in the era of GitHub, it seems like. And
yeah,
benefit from sure. that communication and all the things that came before. So it's just nice to work in a modern tech.
As I understand it, a lot of where Cargo comes from is actually specifically Rails programmers. I think it was like Yehuda Katz and Steve Klabnik got involved with like the Rust folks and kind of like, hey, let's build a package manager that's, you know, similar to Ruby Gems and stuff like that.
And yeah, and Cargo is like awesome. I had my eye on Rust really early on, just because I was already frustrated with the things we were running up against in Atom. And like, so at some point, it was after we shipped Teletype, which was going from kind of not having any clue how we were going to do collaborative editing to like diving into operational transformation. And this is a bit of a tangent, but like,
we love those here.
And, you know, then finding our way to conflict-free replicated data types and building something in JavaScript. Fun story that like, as we were building the initial CRDT, we actually like encountered a bug in the V8 optimizer that caused like a inequality to return incorrectly. And we like rearranged the code and the bug went away.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, we got to the end of that and I really felt like I was a much better programmer at that point. Like something had sort of finally clicked and shifted and I'd reached some new plateau and I was just sick of Atom. Like I just was. I was sick of the constraints and I wanted to start over. But that was a really scary thing to contemplate at the time
sure.
for me, because there was a whole team of people. I didn't have any official leadership role on that team, but I do think I'd been there the longest out of anybody on that team. It was just like, how am I going to tell this team? Like, I think we should do something different. And so that was a process of just, if we were going to just throw this all away and start over, what would we do? Yeah. So that was kind of the beginning of this project X-Ray, which was, you know, I wanted it to be Atom 2.0, but you can't Osborne, or I didn't feel like it was going to be an Osborne Atom at the moment. Yeah, X-Ray was kind of a disaster of a project in the sense that we did not know Rust. And yeah, that project is archived somewhere and you could definitely, I don't know, I would probably be embarrassed by the code that we wrote there. It was kind of like a learning project, but that was kind of the beginning of the journey. And the original idea was like, oh, we'll still have Electron, but we'll write the core of the editor in Rust. And at that time, Rafe Levine and all the ideas around Xi were like really getting a ton of attention. And
yeah,
people were like mad at me for like wanting to do my own exploration. They're like, why don't you just join into Xi?
Oh, really?
I remember writing something of just like, look, I work for GitHub. I'm trying to create a new Atom editor. Like, I want to have control and agency over exactly what we do. I can't like roll up on their project and tell them what to do. It was an interesting, I don't know, but that's kind of me. I always like to kind of do my own thing, be influenced by others, but
I remember when the sort of Xi design principles came out and it was like, we want to build an editor in Rust and it's going to have this architecture for plugins. And I didn't like the JSON part of that, but, and then I do remember very much liking, we're going to go straight to native UI on each of the targets. Like we're going to do, I think at the time, it was, if I remember right, they were going to go to like Cocoa SDK stuff on macOS. But I think GPUI, if I understand correctly, you ended up using like event loop stuff. And I saw this really cool talk on YouTube about how Zed does async Rust and uses executors that are powering the actual, like using the actual native OS event loop as a way to resolve async functions in Rust, as opposed to the traditional like Tokyo or whatever async runtime. That was super cool. But I think for the actual pixels on the screen, that's where the GPU and GPUI comes from, is it's like shaders on the GPU, nothing else in between, right?
Yeah, and it didn't start that way at all. The original design, and it, you know, we rewrote GPUI last fall, but the one preceding it had a bunch of kind of legacy of this architecture where we sort of emitted JSON at an Electron app, and then the Electron would get the JSON and use React to sort of respond and update the views. And it just didn't last that long because it didn't take long before I'm like, this is still slow. complicated.
Because, now it's slow and complicated, right?
Yeah. And I've got two languages I'm worrying about.
I mean, that sounds like the type of thing you do when you're prototyping, where you're like, we just want to get something that works. We know this technology and we're learning this technology, so let's put them together.
Totally. Yeah. And I don't know, like Rust really stumped me for a long time of just like, oh, the single ownership rule. And I just thought, I like would just stare at the screen being like, I don't even know where to even begin.
Oh, yeah.
These problems. I still feel that way a little bit of the time, but most of the time now I don't. Like I know the synapses are built for like yeah. how this is done in Rust, but like at the time it was scary.
My feeling on that has been that the frequency with which I'm just kind of staring at the screen in a state of confusion has decreased over time, but it's never gone all the way to zero. Now it's very rare, but when I got started, I mean, it would just be all the time. I'd be like, what did I get done today? And I'm like, well, I stared at a screen for a while and I thought about stuff and I didn't understand things and I poked and prodded a little bit and then got different errors, which I also didn't understand. I mentioned all this mainly because recently there was a post going around about like Google's experience onboarding Rust, and somebody, one of the quotes from it was something along the lines of, we measured ramp up time of like people learning Rust and Go and C++ and like other languages at Google, and we found that it was like about the same. And I was like, I don't believe you. There's just no way. Like, there's what that tells me is that how you're measuring ramp up has to be wrong, because like I've never met anyone who's had that experience. Everybody has the like stare at the borrow checker errors experience. It's universal. The idea that that's not a major roadblock, or the way that they do ramp up is like you're pair programming all the time with somebody who already knows Rust, so you're not getting stuck on that. If that's the case, I think that's really, like, really giving a wrong impression of like what the normal Rust onboarding experience is like for people learning the language for the first time. I'm not saying it's not worth it, but like it does seem to be like that's the super common story that I hear when people are getting into the language.
Yeah, my favorite little like quote about it is like, the learning curve is like a vertical cliff with like nests of snakes. Spots to bite you, man. As you're climbing, but then you get to the top and you can see the entire world. It's kind of how it does feel like a super weapon now that I'm, you know, approaching. I'm very proficient. I don't know. It's just lovely to be able to, yeah, lean on all the power that the language has. But the journey was not smooth for me at all.
And yeah.
So yeah, at some point, this was like as COVID descended on the world. I remember being like, can we just do our own graphics? Like, and that idea like scared me because I had no idea where to even begin. I'd never done any real graphics programming.
Yeah.
And we used Pathfinder. I used it because I was kind of, it was just me at that point. Like Antonio had worked up with me a bunch, but he had gotten sucked into working on this replicated database for this company Ditto he was working for. And like, so it was just me and a lot of time on my hands, although not as much as some people because I had young kids.
Also big feels.
Yeah, and just like, okay, what if we do our own graphics? Like, I don't even know where this is going. I'm going to try to make this work. And so I used Patrick Walton's Pathfinder project to do the graphics initially. But then I remember a lot of the learning at that point was just like, what is it like to actually just build a freaking Mac app? And I don't want to do Xcode. I don't want to figure this out. Like, in a Mac app in main, what happens? And I didn't want to use any abstraction layers or whatever. I just was like, I want to learn exactly what these Mac APIs are, either find bindings to them or write bindings to them, figure all of that out. That was kind of when some of the early event loop stuff got figured out. Yeah, just kind of stumbling through, like, how do we actually build a native app in Rust?
I love that, because that seems to be, it's starting to feel like, I mean, I'm talking to more and more people who are going down similar journeys, especially people who have this like web development, static typing, lower level kind of journey, where there's this, you reach this point where the thing that becomes really appealing is removing layers. You're like, hey, we're doing like Rust, sending JSON to like Electron. You're like, what if we just subtracted all those layers? How scary could it be down there at the low level? You know, at some level, there is some irreducible, I can't get it any lower level than this because the operating system won't let me. What's that level and how bad is it actually compared to all the stuff I was doing before?
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of why, like, I looked at a few of like UI frameworks in Rust at the time. Everything was really nascent, you know, and this was like the very beginning of, you know, the end of 2019 and then the beginning of 2020.
I remember looking around, yeah. And actually, there was one, I think, I don't know if it was out back then, but there's definitely one that is based on Electron. It's like you write Rust instead of JavaScript, but it's Electron under the hood.
Right. Powery? Is that?
That sounds right. Yeah. I remember, yeah. It sounded like a World of Warcraft race is what I remember.
This is over time, like a philosophy, you know, I've adopted of just, yeah, exactly what you're saying. Where I'm like, okay, if I just understand the primitives,
right?
I know that if I just spin my wheels long enough and hard enough, I can find a way to assemble these primitives into a running application, or I won't, and fine, I'll learn something
right
away. But like, yeah, just cutting out all of the nonsense and going straight to APIs I knew I could understand because they were sort of documented. The documentation's okay of the Mac system APIs, but and that proved to be true. It just took a long time, but yeah.
Yeah, but then like once you get there, the foundation feels awesome. It's like you're in total control and you know that there's no excess cruft that's like you're just stuck depending on, because you're like, well, I put everything there. And if I want to take something out, I know how to take it out. And like, I also know the trade-offs of taking it out.
Yeah.
We had a similar thing with the Rock programming language that I've been working on with the compiler, where Rock is very similar to, it's been less, become less similar over time, but it's certainly in the earliest days, it was very, very similar to the Elm programming language, but with different targets. It was like for different domain, different use cases, but as a language, very similar. Certainly like the type checker and the parser were like very, very similar to Elm. So a question I would get asked all the time is like, well, why didn't you just like start by forking the Elm code base? And part of the answer, and instead I wrote it in Rust, like Elm code base is the compiler's written in Haskell. And part of the answer was performance. It's like I mean, Elm's compiler is quite fast, but I really wanted to have no performance ceiling. I wanted to be like as fast as it could possibly be. And the other reason was just because I wanted to be in charge of all that stuff. I didn't want to have like, well, okay, now I need to optimize stuff, which means I need to like really dig into like how Haskell's, you know, GC works. Like, nah, I don't want to do that. I want to be like, I understand everything that's going on down here. And in fact, if at any point I'm like, I don't like the way that Rust's doing things, I can be like, cool, I'm not even going to depend on that. I could just rip out Rust standard library stuff and just write my own things in C, which is not something I've done a ton of, but just the fact that I'm in charge of all those things and there isn't this extra like thick layer of like a language runtime on top of that, I love that.
Right. And it's also just like a personal journey of I could go adopt something, fork it, tweak it, dig in, try to understand it. But if I build it, I'm really going to understand it.
Yeah.
At least for me, I'm kind of a write-only programmer. Like, like, I don't know. I just really like building things. I like empty canvases. I like control. And maybe that's not the most efficient way to the solution or whatever, or the fastest way. But it's like the most fun way. It starts to get philosophical, existential or something. Yeah.
But I think another aspect of that is just that when I think back on what's the most impressive software I've used, like what are the things where I look at that and I'm like, that's awesome. That's a really big step forward. They're always that way. It seems like they always started from some blank canvas. I mean, Elm being another good example. You could have said to Evan when he was making Elm, like, hey, you know, it's in the same lineage as Haskell. Why don't you start with the Haskell GHC code base? And maybe that's a bad example because GHC's code base is kind of famously like, not the most maintainable. But regardless, I think it's really easy to say, oh, why reinvent the wheel? Why start over? Why start with a blank canvas when you could just pull in all this existing stuff? And then I think a good answer to that is there's a big cost to all that stuff. And like having that as your foundation instead of a foundation that you, yeah, it took longer to make. But once you've got it, wow, can you do stuff that is really, really hard to do if you've got all that legacy stuff underneath you?
Yeah, and it does like everything I want it to do, nothing I don't want it to do, and I understand it 100%.
Yeah, and especially if performance is a goal, it's really, really hard to optimize. I remember spending time doing stuff in the browser. I was working on this one project a long time ago where we needed to render several hundred thousands of polygons in the browser in HTML Canvas. And the optimizations that we were doing, a lot of it had to do with like culling and figuring out, okay, this is going to be out of frame, so don't even draw it. But then also a lot of stuff involved figuring out, well, hang on, what is V8 actually optimizing to? And we had this like interesting question of, yeah, but like, what if they're not using V8? What if they're on a different browser? Like now what, right? And all of these things are just things where, you know, it's really easy to pretend that you're never going to run into that kind of stuff and just be like, yeah, look how much time you're going to spend writing your own thing from scratch. And it's like, yeah, okay, sure. But how much time am I going to spend fighting the thing that I would have built on otherwise that got me to this point once performance becomes the most important thing? And there's a huge amount of time you can get there. And sometimes it's infinite time because you're just like, I just cannot possibly get this performance unless I do a full rewrite.
Yeah, performance is not something you can add in at the end. That's for sure.
And yet somehow there's the mantra of, you know, make it right, make it whatever, make it pretty, make it fast is the last one. I always forget which one of the first two come in, but I don't think that's a good mantra. I think it's first of all, it's more nuanced than that. It's like, think about how you're going to someday make it fast and architect it in a way that you can in the future, even if you're not doing every micro optimization right now at this exact moment. Avoid painting yourself into performance corners, maybe. That's not as pithy, but I mean...
I catch myself doing this still and like, stop. You're just like, oh, I can avoid an allocation here. And it's just like, okay, but like, and I'll still do it. Like, I'll go pick up the $20 on the sidewalk if it's just laying there. But if I'm finding myself bending over backwards to avoid an allocation, then it's time to ask myself, how hot is this code path really?
Right.
So I think there's wisdom in that, but maybe people were like, I probably cargo culted it earlier in my career. I'm just like, oh yeah, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Fine.
But I think it also depends on like having some awareness of what's the scope of what you're trying to build. Like in my mind, if I look at a music player, for example, like going back to the Winamp example, I would love to live in a world where you can write something like that in a high level language. That's like one of the use cases I would like people to someday be able to use Rock for, is like build a music player that just runs. And because essentially the UI for that is just not that complicated. And like the amount of data that's going through that system, yeah, like, okay, the actual audio stuff is, there's high performance stuff in there, but you're probably just going to be shelling out to a C library, possibly just an OS API anyway, that's going to be doing all the heavy lifting there. But then like for the actual UI Chrome, like the list of songs and stuff like that, that shouldn't be that heavyweight of a lift. You shouldn't need to be saying, how do I optimize every allocation in here to make that UI work? I don't think. Having said that, there's also other use cases like an editor, like a compiler, where you're like, how nice of a user experience it is to use this thing is going to depend very, very directly on how fast it is. And for those use cases, I don't want to compromise. Now, granted, I have noticed that the more time on a daily basis you find yourself using that piece of software, the more you tend to care about performance. Like if I'm booking a flight, which is something I do multiple times per year, but not daily, if you're like, hey, could you make that process 50% faster? I'd be like, that'd be nice. But I don't care that much. Mainly, I care about how expensive are the flights, you know, stuff like that. There's like how fast can I click through the buttons is like kind of low on my list. But with like an editor or with a browser itself, stuff like that, it's like, yeah, no, this is a much bigger deal.
Yeah, I mean, although, you know, my girlfriend will tell you to her chagrin how much I'm being like, why can't this be less buggy, faster, just better? Like, did the people built this care? And like, I'm sure they did, and they were under constraints that were unreasonable or whatever it is. You know, I try to take a deep breath, but like, I in general wish all software were better.
I totally agree. I mean, I definitely like, as a point of pride, as like somebody who builds software, I want in general the software in the world to run faster and be less buggy. And it feels like we can do better, but we don't for various reasons that would take a long time to unpack. But I mean, one of the reasons that I wanted to make Rock in the first place was it should be possible for people to make software where like they had a good experience writing it. and like the language feels nice and simple. It builds really fast. It runs really fast by default, up to a point, obviously. Like, I still wouldn't write an editor in Rock. And I also don't plan on self-hosting the compiler either. And like, people always ask me that. They're like, when are you going to self-host the compiler? I'm like, definitely never, because I still want the maximum control, because this is one of those use cases where like...
You're not building a language for writing the compiler, right?
Exactly, right. That too. Yeah. Nevertheless, I do think that there are so many businesses, because I've also done multiple startups myself. I've worked for a handful of different startups. And when you're under the gun and you're like, okay, we have this business. Our business is not making technology. Our business is education. We're making stuff for teachers, you know, whatever. It's like they just want to be able to build stuff quickly that works well. And I've heard this case made before. Well, you just need better discipline. You need to like care more about your craft. Okay, it's like, yeah, but you know, at some point, you're like startup, you run out of money. And so if you just like, you're like, well, we really cared about our craft. We did go out of business and now the product doesn't do anything because it's gone. But along the way, boy, did we make really high quality code. There's a sort of natural selection process that leads startups to not have as high a survival rate as those that are kind of move fast and break things-y. And we might not like it, but that's just how the incentives are.
Yeah, I know. It's a really painful reality that I'm like constantly cognizant of as someone who found himself starting a company because I was obsessed with quality and performance and all these, you know, technical virtues. You know, it's always there. The wolf is always kind of there at the door, like reminding me, like, you've got to balance that desire off with just shipping.
Yeah.
Nobody cares how you did it. They care how you did it as long as they're using a product that ships and that has all the features they want. And so,
well, it sounds like you've done a good job aligning your interests with a business that needs things to be aligned that way. Because if you have an editor that's like really buggy and crashes all the time, people are going to be a lot less forgiving of that than they are if, you know, their cat photo website, you know, is crashing from time to time or has bugs.
Yeah, I remember it's too long of a story, but I tried to build something that wasn't an editor and just spent all my time nerd sniping myself writing an ORM in Ruby that did all this crazy translation of like relational algebra, you know, constructed in like a graph, you know, where you could create unions and arbitrary relational algebraic expressions out of objects on the heap and then compiling that to SQL. It was a really exciting problem, but then, you know, N months later, I was just, what am I doing?
Like, where are the cats on this website?
Yeah. So I resolved after that. That was kind of when I decided I wanted to go back to the original vision I had of building an editor. Because I'm like, I just have to have a problem that's inherently really freaking hard. Because I will make the problem hard if I isn't.
Yeah.
Like, my mind needs the challenge to dig into. And so it felt like an editor was a good fit of just, this is inherently hard. And, you know, if you don't understand algorithms, which I didn't well enough when I started Adam, but if you don't understand things pretty intensely, like you're not going to produce a good product. Yeah, that's worked out. Taking more dilution than maybe we absolutely, you know, just being very conservative in terms of our first and second raises where I've just, okay, this could take some time. So we're going to, you know, raise more money than we think we need and then spend it as slowly as we can, buy ourselves that wiggle room. Yeah. So,
I mean, kudos to you. Cause like Zed has become my main editor for doing all my like Rust stuff. Like all my Rock editing has just all Zed. And I'm not even using the multiplayer features for that, which is like some of the coolest parts of it. Cause I have done a bunch of pair programming in the past and I really, really enjoy it. But what I've never had the experience of is this. I mean, you have some cool videos up about this. Basically, the like two people editing like the same source code file, and you can do stuff like you can say one person's like, I'm going to fix this top. Like, we just agreed on something to do. I'm going to fix this top one. You fix the bottom one. And you just like both just do it. Or like one person's in one file. Another person's like, oh, I'm going to go make the same change in another file. And it's all in the same file system. Like that type of stuff is really, really exciting because the big downside of pair programming has always been, you know, people will say like the original extreme programming thing was like, no, you're like definitely getting stuff faster. I'm like, I don't think so. Like there's lots of benefits, but the cost is that if you had two individuals and they weren't pairing and they were each working independently on different projects, like I think you would have higher throughput. That's like, seems like that should be uncontroversial, but somehow it's not. But this seems like it dramatically reduces that downside. If it's like both people can be talking and typing at the same time about the same code base on the same screen, that's pretty wild and like seems like a game changer to me. But even not using that on Rock stuff, I'm just like, yeah, this editor is really fast. And also the Vim mode actually works. Like I've been like a longtime Vim user who has been always frustrated by the fact that it's like the UI is constrained by like monospace characters, and I don't use the mouse that much, but there are some times when I'm like, I really wish I had mouse right now, because the discoverability of this action that I do very infrequently is terrible, and I wish I had like a menu where I could like right click to see what's available to me, and instead there's like, what keystroke combination do I press for this like obscure thing, and it's this big distraction. But at any rate, I finally ended up with, after many years of being like, all right, I'm rage quitting Vim. I also like the plugins that always break. I'm just going to Atom. And then I would eventually be like, no, I'm going back to Vim. And then I'd be like, all right, I'll try VS Code. Okay. And then finally, I'm like, oh, Zed actually, I guess because it's baked in the Vim integration, it's not just an extension, but everything actually seems to work. Like all the motions work. I mean, there's some missing features like marks, but all the stuff that works, it's actually not buggy. And the fact that that's not buggy when you have the VS Code Vim, the most popular Vim integration, is it's definitely over a million downloads. I mean, it's like an insane number of people have used it. VS Code, millions of dollars has been put into it. Zed is like a handful of people who've just been working really, really hard at a really high level of quality, and it gets a better outcome. Like, I've never used a Vim integration that's this good. I know how much less time has been put into it in terms of absolute hours than they have been in those other scenarios. But I attribute that level of quality to this philosophy that you've taken to the project, where you're like, I am going to put in the hours. I am going to start with a really blank slate and just be like, let's build this thing from scratch to be really, really high quality and take the time to do that. Like, it really shows. I mean, this is like, I wish that there were more software projects that would take that mentality. Because if I imagine, if you take the mentality of basically all the startups I've worked for in the past, where it's like, number one thing is we just got to ship, ship, ship. If you apply that project, that mentality to the project of Zed, I don't think you get this outcome. I don't see how that's remotely possible.
Yeah. Our seed investor, Lee, he was like really patient.
Nice.
He's just used to seeing, you know, we had nothing for a really long time.
Yeah, I bet.
Because we're busy randomized testing data structures that we knew needed to be right. And, you know, that resulted in like, quite a long time to like pixels on the screen. We had pixels quick, but like we spent a lot of time on things that were not visible. And, you know, I remember at one point, it's just because I was like, we have, you know, N years of runway. He's like, if this is going to take that long, you need to hire. I don't know if that's going to get us there any quicker.
I remember I was telling a friend about Zed who hadn't heard of it. And he's like a big distributed systems guy. And I was telling him about the multiplayer thing and like how you could like simultaneously edit files. And he was like, oh, that's really cool. I bet they're not using CRDTs, but like, it sounds like a really, I was like, it's all CRDTs. He was like, whoa.
We need to go further with it because I feel like the pieces of it that we implemented more client server are like the parts of the system that give us the most grief. Meaning the buffers are CRDTs, but a lot of the rest of the experience is, you know, just because we had gotten burned from this other project, Memo, where I wanted to build a CRDT that covered the entire repo. And it was probably just too much to bite off at that point. And then GitHub product managers were just like, what the hell are you guys doing? And it's so great. Okay.
So maybe I should go back to my friend and say, it's all CRDTs in the buffers, but everything else.
Exactly. We want to build CRDB. We started on it last summer and then kind of paused it to focus on getting a bunch of other things dealt with and open sourcing, et cetera, but like kind of the next era of collaboration in Zed. And that's another thing. It's just like the joy of kind of getting to a plateau so that you can revisit fundamental assumptions of the system and revolutionize. So yeah, I think there will be kind of a next phase where we go even more hardcore into CRDTs and extend it to the entire repo and add persistence and go further. Antonio's like freaking chomping at the bit to get started on that. And we just prioritize it. But hopefully this summer we'll get back into it.
Well, I remember another design decision that I love is, I remember I was watching stuff about like the extension system, which I think at the time, like the video or the interview or something I was watching, like didn't exist yet. Like now it's out. But I remember hearing about it and thinking like, oh man, I really hope they don't make JavaScript the configuration and like system after all this work to like make everything super fast. Like the extensions are going to be slow. And I also remember thinking, well, I know in VS Code, they do process isolation to make sure that extensions can't mess with each other because they can like, you know, do C API like interop and stuff like that. And that's unsafe and whatnot. And I remember thinking, WebAssembly, that's the answer. I really want to let these guys know about WebAssembly. And then, of course, the extension API comes out and it's based on WebAssembly. I was like, awesome. This is great.
That is, maybe we were talking about this the other day, like WIT. What does WIT stand for? But anyway, it's basically like the facility that some very cool people involved with WebAssembly built to allow you to expose an interface from your WebAssembly module into an embedding program, broker all the calls across that boundary. And we had played with Wit early on and it wasn't fully baked yet. And I was like, okay, like this isn't going to work because it's just too hard to figure out how to really expose like a rich API into the extension. And then at some point I actually tweeted at somebody from the Zed account, like, oh yeah, we're going to add, you know, JavaScript based extensions, because I'd kind of given up on WebAssembly just because I was like, it's going to be too much innovation to figure out how to like expose a good API. And then Max started digging in and like, I think it was like 2 days in, he took another look at Wit and realized that right about when we open sourced Zed, they had landed like the features we needed in Wit to do a pure WASM implementation.
Oh, beautiful.
We're not doing it. But the thought there was just the thing motivating it was just like, well, at least I know I can embed an interpreter and like expose post facilities to it. And there's like a paved path there. But yeah, thank God that group finished that work. And
well, there's actually some tool. It's called Javy or Javy, J-A-V-Y at any rate, that like came out of Bytecode Alliance. That's, according to the website at least, what it does is you give it JavaScript and it will compile it into WebAssembly. So you don't need like an actual JavaScript runtime. Now, granted, the performance is going to be worse there. But I mean, one of the things that I always think about is there's always trade-offs between making stuff that's sort of easy to use right now and then also trying to move away from the downsides of the thing that's easy to use right now. So it's like, if you say WebAssembly is like the core and that's what you build the extensions on, if there's some path for someone to say, okay, I've got this existing extension, I just want to port it in so I can like get it up and running, but you're not coupled to JavaScript and it's not, the extensions have to be written in JavaScript. It's just like, well, people who want to port extensions just to get kind of an 80-20, maybe it's not as fast as possible, but at least they can have something. There's a path where they can do that, but also there's a really obvious path to like, okay, now that that exists, somebody can set up to do the harder thing that takes longer of making an extension in a much faster language that can just, you know, run a WebAssembly like Rust or Rock.
And like, the reality is, I don't know, it really boiled down to like, I want to write Rust. I don't know. There's a lot of like selfishness involved in decisions we make in Zed as well of just like, what do I want?
But the nice thing about WebAssembly is it's like you get what you want, but also there's other people out there who want something different and they can still get it and get the best performance you can get while still having the sort of safety guardrails that you need if you're going to be running a bunch of extensions from other people's code.
Right. And also just like the distribution story. Yeah, there is a distribution story.
Well, yes, that's also important.
as opposed to like just a C ABI or something, which, yeah, I mean, I think we barely dipped a pinky toe in the extension story, just getting kind of like language servers and grammars underway. As we get further in, I'm imagining, you know, there's going to be like a Rust API that's exposed to the, I don't really know, but I have a feeling there'll be like some kind of like Rust runtime that's running in the WASM side of your extension that's then talking over the Wit bridge. But maybe not. Maybe it'll be 100% pure, just like Wit, you know, just the interface, and you could use whatever you want. And that would be cool too.
And if you let people bring their own, then people can write things like, I'm obviously selfishly thinking of Rock, like people could write extensions in Rock because Rock does compile to WebAssembly. And actually the way that Rock is designed as a language is actually kind of Wit-like, without going into a huge tangent, but it's designed to be, when you make your Rock application, you pick a quote unquote platform to build on. And that platform is essentially some sort of low level, it's kind of like a framework, but also kind of like a runtime where like it's responsible for memory allocation and stuff like that. Like the Rock standard library doesn't have any notion of like IO, and it even doesn't have baked in memory allocation. It's that whatever platform you pick that you're going to sort of compile down to, that thing is responsible for the allocation. So you can say stuff, you know, I'm going to run in a database even if you want. It's like taking the idea that you have for the async executor that's based on the operating system primitives, except instead of, so it is that way for all of your IO primitives, but also for all of like memory management and stuff like
that's
that.
Very cool.
So it's using it to build plugins for an editor has always been one of the ideas, because separately we've talked for a long time about like having a Rock specific editor, like going back to the Visual Basic days, but also for like editors in general. Like I'd always had in my mind, I was like, I don't want to learn Vim script, but like I want to write Vim plugin. Where's the language that can do that? And yeah, I mean, Rock would be, I think, a natural fit for writing Zed extensions, assuming that that's something that's, you know, realistic, because it's like, yeah, we compile down to WebAssembly and like you could just write those. It's no problem.
Yeah. It's a good reminder as we like explore further the what it looks like to open up more surface area to extensions. Yeah, maybe it is something, or it's a trade-off to consider pretty strongly, I guess, how rusty we make our assumptions on the other side of that boundary, you know? If there's an opportunity to make them more agnostic, that's definitely worth assigning some value to.
So coincidentally, I originally, like in the very first design for Rock, my idea was that all the platforms would always have to be written in Rust. And the idea was that we were going to compile down to like basically Rust code. And then at some point I realized that was going to be too slow because like the Rust compiler was too slow. Kind of similar to you and GPUI. I was like, no, we got to go straight to, well, LLVM, but actually we have our own separate backends that just go straight to machine code because LLVM is also too slow, like normally. Yeah, one of which is actually the most fully featured of which is the WebAssembly backend. So if you go to rock-lang.org, there's an online REPL. It's all 100% WebAssembly. It's like 2 megabytes of the entire compilers in there. And it's all just generating WASM on the fly. No LLVM, anything like right there in the browser. It's like, it's really fast. It's like instantaneous. And it's all type checking, you know, everything as you type it and full type.
I got to admit, like I haven't dug that much into Rock, but you're getting me.
Not a lot of people have.
And yeah, the idea of sort of taking some of the sensibilities and learnings of the strongly typed world and nice type systems, coupling that with a super, you know, someone that's obsessed with writing a fast compiler.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved the compile speed of Go. It was just the type system left a lot to be desired, at least at the time. Maybe they've added generics, but I missed some types. There were a bunch of things that...
Now that they have generics, some types is the thing that everybody complains about, like the error handling.
Yeah, and the idea of like having a language that is a little more... fluid to work with for writing extensions is actually like, you know, in the extension world, yeah, making it have more of a scripty vibe, but still be statically typed and fast.
Well, so there's also another funny analogy here between like another thing that we did in Rock. So I actually, one of the things that kind of sold me on not compiling to Rust, I mean, I'd already sort of made that decision, but I remember I was speaking at a conference and I went to the speaker dinner and the first person I happened to walk into, right when I walked into the door, I introduced myself. And I was like, hey, I'm making a programming language. He's like, oh, me too. I was like, what's it called? And he's like, Zig. And I was like, I've never heard of that.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's Andrew Kelly. So
yeah,
that was how I learned about Zig. And he was talking to it and I was explaining this like whole platforms thing. And he was like, no, you should don't couple it to Rust. And of course he would say that. But he was right. And he was like, look, you know, keep platforms weird, man. Let people like you don't need to have that restriction on it. Let people do whatever they want. He was totally right. And now we already have some like awesome platforms that are not written in Rust, which would not exist if I had like made that decision. And it also reminds me of there's this interesting tension, which I kind of referenced a little bit earlier, but there's two different questions. One is, how do you get to the sort of like the ideal world where everything is written in this like from scratch in this like super fast, awesome way. But then there's also this question of how do you get people using the thing enough to motivate someone to build in that system in the first place? And both in the case of Rock as a language and in the case of Zed as an editor, you know, with the extension ecosystem and a package ecosystem, there is always this question of like, how do you bridge that gap? And the answer usually has to be some form of like giving people some way to build on stuff that already exists that is not ideal, but as sort of temporary transitionary, you know, route to getting to the nicer thing. So in Rock's case, we have this really hardcore, the package ecosystem shall only be .rock files. There's no CFFI, like synchronous CFFI. There's no way to say, I'm going to bring in lib this or that, none of that stuff, which makes the build system really nice. You don't have to ever worry about like, oh, lib such and such wasn't on my, oh God, now, you know. But in the interim, people are like, how do I do this? How do I do that? Like, this doesn't exist here. I don't want to rewrite that from scratch. And the platforms are sort of are out there where you can say, well, if you just fork your platform, you can add it as a platform primitive and expose that to your application. That's not as ergonomic as if someone wrote it in Rock. So like, there's a clear benefit both to ergonomics and in a lot of cases to performance, probably, depending on what the thing you're bringing in is. But at the end of the day, it gives people a way to answer both of those questions. And I can see that for in Zed's case being a really nice benefit where it's like, hey, if you want to build the fastest possible extension, you got to do it in Rust. But if you're not ready for that, you can start off by just taking the VS Code extension or something like that, running it through Javi or whatever. Like, here's a little script you can run.
Works, like really compiling JavaScript to WebAssembly where you're having like
it's a good question.
Reflector baked into it, I'm imagining.
Right.
And like
some sort of automatic memory management. Yeah. I have no idea. I've never used it. I just like read about it briefly. My guess would be that the performance would be significantly worse than like V8 or something like that.
But you don't always need blazing performance. It's oftentimes just some little pile of logic that just doesn't need to run that fast, but it's critical to the people that are depending on it.
Yeah, I can see it being the type of thing where it's like, this works, but wow, is there demand for somebody to write the better version? But just the fact that it works is kind of a big deal. Like, actually, so for those who don't know, Zed's grammars for like syntax highlighting are all done in TreeSitter. Like when you said Max earlier, that's Max who created TreeSitter, which has all these really, really cool benefits, that the fact that Zed does that. But it does mean that you can't just copy paste the old regular expressions. Oh my God. Which actually, VS Code uses TextMate. I assume Adam did the same thing, like TextMate grammars for regular expressions for syntax highlighting.
Yeah, they link Onigiruma or whatever. Maybe they have an Onigiruma JS now or something, but yeah.
I have no idea, yeah. But anyway, so somebody had been working on a TreeSitter grammar for Rock, and I was like kind of nudging like, hey, can we get that going on Zed? I would love to have syntax highlighting for Rock and Zed. And now the like work has resumed on that, which is great. But it's definitely like the fact that people don't just have some way to like say, oh, I want to just copy paste my existing syntax highlighting over and like get that. It's a little bit of a barrier. Now, granted, making a TreeSitter grammar is a lot less work than making like Rust Analyzer, obviously, but which, you know, I guess you have the language server protocol for those type of things, which I have my own. If I were making that, I probably would not have chosen JSON RPC between processes, but maybe that's part of why it's been so successful is that decision. I don't know, but I'm not a fan of that design decision. I'll say that.
Yeah. And again, it's like many protocols, like it's probably grown up over time and maybe they wish they would have done things differently, but now there's a ton of things that are on both sides of that protocol. So it kind of
simplifies
over time.
Right. I mean, it definitely seems like part of the mindset of like, hey, web technologies, the performance is going to be fine. Right. And I mean, to a point.
One thing I would love in the fullness of time is to not use LSP forever for everything. Be able to have a WebAssembly extension that's able to do all the work of and have direct access to, you know, read the buffers. Obviously, you're copying it to and from the WebAssembly memory and like the native heap, but you're just like a little more cozy of a relationship, I guess, with the actual data.
Okay, so I saw this in a blog post and I was really curious about this. Maybe you know the answer, but I was kind of surprised that copying was necessary. I mean, I get it in the sense of maybe it's about like Rust ownership and things like that. But if I were writing C, I couldn't think of a reason why I couldn't just be like, well, yeah, I'm just going to take addresses into the WebAssembly heap and I'm going to read them. I'm not going to write to them because that could mess up invariants on the WebAssembly side. But it's like if an extension has like written a bunch of stuff into memory, I couldn't think of a reason why you couldn't, from the editor side, just be like, oh, I want to go read that memory. Don't copy it anywhere. Just give me a pointer to it and I'll just go read it out of your heap because you're not executing right now. I'm in charge of that. So,
yeah, I have not thought deeply enough about WebAssembly. And yeah, Max honestly may have a better answer. He's worked with it more. But I guess the conclusion that I've come to is like, you know, a small amount of copying is no big deal. Like, anytime you're doing a function call in a language that had, you know, where you're having value semantics, there's a certain amount of copying going on as long as it's kind of like bite-sized.
Yeah, yeah, right.
amount for like that call. And typically you're never gonna want to like look at a gigabyte of something at once. Like
true.
Gigabyte in size and you're kind of getting one byte of it at a time as you're streaming or you're, you know, so it doesn't seem like that big of a deal as a constraint.
That's totally fair. This is just like my version of like you mentioned, like, oh, can we save an allocation? That's just my brain going there immediately. It's just like, wait, do we have to? Do we have to copy it?
That was my initial stance of just like, really? But then as I thought about it, I talked myself into that narrative. I just articulated.
Yeah, I've had the same thing many times in things at the Rock compiler where I'm like, okay, like it kind of conceptually bothers me, but like it's probably not actually causing a problem. Like it's the type of thing where I have to tell myself, I'm like, look, if you really suspect it's a problem, you should go like actually measure it. And if you don't suspect it's a problem enough to actually measure it, then like you probably shouldn't be worrying about it.
But one thing I am excited about is just like, you know, being able to hold a reference to some large object that's got a huge amount of memory on our native heap. and in, you know, a very fine-grained way without going across a process boundary and deserializing JSON, start to like, yeah, have these like fine-grained interactions. I'm really excited about that direction.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that was always one of my goals for Rock is like going back to like my earliest public presentation about this in like 2020, I talked about wanting to do this is like, I've always felt that there was this big missed opportunity in languages to have an ecosystem of editor plugins that are tailored to packages. So as an example, like let's say I have a regular expression package or a parser package. Why is it that when I install that package, I don't just automatically get editor tooling that's like a regular expression explorer or that like lets me, you know, scrub through in real time in a debugger and see like, oh, what's being captured, what's not, you know, what's being greedily consumed, what's not. There's all of this like potential for really interesting tooling that's not just language specific, but package specific. And my conclusion was like, the reason this doesn't happen is essentially that you would have to duplicate that for every editor that everyone's using in your language. Cause like, you know, it's like, oh, now I got to make a Vim one of those. Now I got to make an and like people like package authors are just not going to do that. So right. One of my goals for Rock has always been to try to make a standardized way to do that. That's just like the phrase I like to use is it should be as easy to write an editor extension in Rock as it is to write a function. Like you write a function, you press enter, you go down a line and you start typing and you're writing an extension right there. It's just like a different keyword, you know?
Oh, that's very sweet. Like integrated with the language itself.
Kind of. That's the goal. Yeah. And so when you install a package, there isn't a separate install the package specific extension process. It's just like you install the package and then you got the thing. Now, originally I thought, well, if we're going to do this, we have to build our own editor. There's no way any editor is going to support this. Later on, I realized that we could do this by making it so that the Rock extension for each of these individual editors is like smart enough to be able to do that. And then it knows how to do that. So somebody still has to do the work for Vim and Emacs and Zed and VS Code to do that. But that only has to be done once. And then now they all understand this format. And then now you actually can get the experience. I'm like, no, I installed my regular expression package. So like, of course I have the tooling with it. And like, and there's no runtime cost to any of that. It's just like, that's just part of the file. It's like in the source code file, but it's not, you know, the compiler is just like, oh, that's for the editor. I'll just ignore that, you know, that type of stuff.
Making like editor tooling part of the ecosystem assumptions.
Yeah.
In the same way that, you know, Cargo brought a certain set of assumptions about dependency management, et cetera. It's like a level up for the ecosystem of the set of expectations.
Right. Because it seems like editor tooling is this huge opportunity for people to become like when I'm a package author, I create something that's like, it's not just that I make something that's useful for me and for other people, but it's like, it's somewhat of a force multiplier because other people can build on my package and they can make other useful stuff. And so it multiplies out. But like, there's an equivalent, I think, potential benefit there for package specific tooling where it's like, when I write tooling for this package, it's also helping out everybody who's using my package, but also potentially people who are debugging packages that work on that package or that use that package as a dependency. So there's again, like, it's like a different level of force multiplier that just is totally untapped right now. Like I think about like in the React ecosystem, for example, you get like, I remember back in the day, like Redux had its own tooling. And of course there's like React specific tooling and Rails, there's Rails specific tooling. But it's only for like the top 0.1% most popular software libraries in the world. Like everybody else is just sort of like, yeah, you just, I don't know, you get nothing. And that's just how it is. It's like, what if we lowered the barrier to the point where it was just like a cultural norm that like everybody did that? Like you're going to ship your package. You're like, well, I'm going to ship documentation. I'm also going to make a little bit of tooling for it because that's just what everybody expects. That's a world I want to live in.
Yeah. And that was a very similar sentiment was like inspiring me in the early days of Atom. I'm just like, oh, we just have to make it so easy to create tooling that everybody does it. And it kind of worked out. I mean, I think the issue with Atom was like giving everybody the power to make all that amazing tooling, giving people the power to make all that amazing tooling quickly meant that the editor couldn't be as amazing as it needed to be. And I think VS Code, they have a pretty rich tooling ecosystem, but they give people a lot less power. And with that reduction in power, they've been able to maintain a better editor experience, I think. And so it's a different side of the trade-off, but like the ideal is sort of approaching this, a great editor experience and a really easy, accessible tool authoring experience that gives people a lot of power. Like that's the holy grail.
Yeah.
That we need to get to.
Well, and I ran into, I guess it was a bit of a like helpful revelation in terms of like the trade-off between like, how do you give people a certain amount of power without going overboard and like boxing yourself in on API constraints? And the point where I realized, oh, we could just do this for every editor. We don't have to make our own editor and try to convince everyone to use it. was when I started thinking about specifically, like, what's the API going to be for this? And then I started asking myself, okay, well, what's the accessibility story here? Because if accessibility isn't sort of the default, like it is in browsers and the DOM, people just aren't going to do it. What I realized was that what I need to do is design an API that is expressed not in terms of pixels on the screen, but in terms of much, much more coarse-grained primitives, such as, hey, I need a number input for this thing to work. I need you to specify this thing, or I'm going to give you a dropdown that's like select from one of these options. And at that point, I realized, oh, if it's going to be something that's sort of general enough that a screen reader could do a good enough job presenting it, it's going to be possible to implement that set of primitives for also for Vim and Emacs and like every other editor. Right. They're going to look different in each of those. And of course, but they're going to look different for the screen reader, et cetera. So at that point, I sort of realized like, oh, well, if we have to solving it for screen readers pretty much implies solving it for other use cases. Now, granted, there's some set of plugins that are sort of inherently visual, where it's like, if you want to do a color picker, it's like, okay, I don't know what the screen reader version of that could even possibly be. So at some level, there has to be some way to like make a thing that's only useful for sighted users, because that's just the nature of that particular tool. But the hope would be that you can design it in a way where that's not the like obvious default that everybody reaches for. And it's like actually more convenient to make something that's going to work well with screen readers and therefore also work across editors.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Being more data driven. And the trick is, you know, the easy button for us was just like, you can do anything.
right. Yeah.
You know, short-term win, long-term pain. But yeah, finding that right design and that data driven protocol or whatever of exactly the right types of things that you're going to allow people to do. That's
hard.
Glad you're doing that work and doing that thinking, actually.
Yeah. I mean, and like C is kind of the same problem, right? It's like, you can do anything. And it's like, be careful what you wish for. Yeah. Nice. Well, Nathan, this has been great. Anything else we should talk about before we wrap up?
I probably should take a break before my next thing I need to do eventually. Cool. So, yeah, you're really fun to talk to, man.
Yeah, this is a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. I really appreciate you taking the time to do it.
Thanks for sharing your podcast with me.
Yeah, thanks for being on it. Appreciate it. Take care.
Well, thanks everybody for listening this long.
Yes, it was a good one.